The old Empire Thought Control operation is run by a small group of old baboons with very small minds. They are playing insidious games with no purpose and no goal other than to control and destroy SBs who could otherwise manage themselves perfectly well, if left alone. These types of artificially created incidents are being forced upon the human race by the operators of the mind control prison system. The prison guards will always promote and support oppressive or totalitarian activities of SBs on Earth. Why not keep the inmates fighting between themselves? Why not empower madmen to run the governments of Earth? The men who run the criminal governments of Earth mirror the commands given them by covert thought controllers of the old empire. The human race will continue to shadow box with this for a long time, as long as it remains the human race. Until then, the SBs on Earth will continue to live a series of consecutive lives, over and over and over. The same SBs who lived during the rise and fall of civilizations in India, China, Mesopotamia, Greece, and Rome are inhabiting bodies in the present time in America, France, Russia, Africa, and around the world. 137 In between each lifetime an SB is sent back again, to begin all over. As through the new life was the only life they had ever lived. They begin anew in pain, in misery, and mystery. Some SBs have been transported to Earth more recently than others. Some SBs have been on Earth only a few hundred years, so they have no personal experiences with the earlier civilizations of Earth. They have no experiences of having lived on Earth, so could not remember a previous existence here, even if their memory was restored. They might, however, remember lives they lived elsewhere on other planets and in other times. Others have been here since the first days of Lemuria. In any case, the SBs of Earth are here forever, until they can break the amnesia cycle, conquer the electronic traps set up by their captors and free themselves. Because the domain has 3,000 of their own SBs in captivity on Earth also, they have an interest in solving this problem. This problem has never been encountered or effectively solved before in the universe, as far as they know. They will continue their efforts to free those SBs from Earth, where and when it is possible, but it will require time to develop an unprecedented technology and the diligence to do so. Editor's note: the following statement is a comment by Matilda. I think it is L's sincere desire, as one SB to another, that the rest of our eternity will be as pleasant as possible. 138 Chapter 14 Air reviews the interview transcripts. Matilda O'Donnell McElroy personal note: shortly after I finished recounting the previous interview with Air to the stenographer, I was summoned urgently to the office of the commanding officer of the base. I was escorted by four heavily armed military policemen. When I arrived, I was asked to be seated in a very large, makeshift office that had been arranged with a conference table and chairs. In the office were several dignitaries I had seen at various times in the gallery. I recognized a few of them because they were famous men. I was introduced to these men, which included Army Air Force Secretary Symington, 235, footnote, General Nathan Twining, 236, footnote, General Jimmy Doolittle, 237, footnote, General Vandenberg, 238, footnote, and General Norstad, 239, footnote. Much to my surprise, Charles Lindbergh, 240, footnote, was also in the office. Secretary Symington explained to me that Mr. Lindbergh was there as a consultant to the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force. There were several other men present in the room who were not introduced. I assume these men were personal aides to the officers or agents or some intelligence service. All of this sudden attention, not only from the secretary and generals, but from such world-famous people as Mr. Lindbergh and General Doolittle, made me realize how critically important my role as an interpreter for Earl was, as seen through the eyes of others. Until this time I was not really aware of this except in an peripheral sense. I suppose this was because I was so absorbed in details of the extraordinary situation. Suddenly, I began to grasp the magnitude of my role. I think that the presence of these men in that meeting was intended, in part, to impress me with this fact. The secretary instructed me not to be nervous. He said that I was not in any trouble. He asked me if I thought the alien would be willing to answer a list of questions they had prepared. He explained that they were very eager to discover many more details about L, the flying disc, the domain, and many other subjects that L had disclosed in the interview transcripts. Of course, they were mainly interested in questions relating to the military security and the construction of the flying disc. I told them that I was very sure that L had not changed her mind about answering questions, as nothing had changed that would cause her to trust the intentions of their 139 men in the gallery. I repeated that L had communicated everything that she was willing and at liberty to discuss already. In spite of this, they insisted that I would ask L again if she would answer questions. And, if the answer was still no, I was to ask her if she would be willing to read the written copies of the transcripts of my interview translations. They wanted to know if L would verify that my understanding and translation of our interviews was correct. Since L could read English very fluently, the secretary asked if they could be allowed to observe for themselves while L read the transcripts, and verify that they were correct in writing. They wanted her to write on a copy of the transcript whether the translations were correct or not, and make a note of anything that was not accurate on the transcripts. Of course, I had no choice but to obey orders, and I did exactly what the secretary requested. I was given a copy of the transcripts, with a signature page, which I was to show to L. After L completed her review, I was also directed to request that L sign the cover page, attesting that all of the translations in the transcripts were correct, as amended by her. About an hour later, I entered the interview room, as instructed, with copies of the transcripts and signature page to deliver to L as the members of the gallery, including the generals, and Mr. Lindbergh also, I presume, and others watched through the glass of the gallery room. I went to my usual seat, sitting 4 or 5 feet across from L. I presented the envelope of transcripts to L, and passed on the instructions I had received from the secretary, telepathically. L looked at me, and looked at the envelope, without accepting it. L said, "If you have read them and they are accurate in your own estimation, there is no need for me to review them also. The translations are correct. You can tell your commander that you have faithfully conveyed a record of our communication." I assured L that I had read them, and they were exact recordings of everything I told the transcription typist. "Will you sign the cover page then?" I asked. "No, I will not," said L. "May I ask why not?" I said. I was a little confused as to why she wasn't willing to do such a simple thing. 140. If your commander does not trust his own staff to make an honest and accurate report to him, what confidence will my signature on the page give him? Why will he trust an ink mark on a page made by an officer of the domain, if he does not trust his own, loyal staff? I didn't quite know what to say to that. I couldn't argue with Elle's logic, and I couldn't force her to sign the document either. I sat in my chair for a minute wondering what to do next. I thanked Elle and told her I needed to go ask my superiors for further instructions. I placed the envelope of the transcripts in the inside breast pocket of my uniform jacket and began to rise from my chair. At that moment, the door from the gallery room slammed open. 5 heavily armed military police rushed into the room. A man in a white laboratory coat followed closely behind them. He pushed a small cart that carried a box-shaped machine with a lot of dials on the face of it. Before I could react, 2 of the MPs grabbed Elle and held her firmly down in the overstuffed chair she had been sitting on since the first day of our interviews together. The 2 other MPs grabbed my shoulders and pushed me back down on my chair and held me there. The other MP stood directly in front of Elle, pointing a rifle directly at her, not more than 6 inches from her head. The man in the lab coat quickly wheeled the cart behind Elle's chair. He deftly placed a circular headband over Elle's head and turned back to the machine on the cart. Suddenly, he shouted the word "clear." The soldiers who were holding Elle released her. At that instant, I saw Elle's body stiffen and shudder. This lasted for about 15 or 20 seconds. The machine operator turned a knob on the machine and El's body slumped back into the chair. After a few seconds, he turned the knob again and El's body stiffened as before. He repeated the same process several more times. I sat in my chair, being held down all the while by the MPs. And I didn't understand what was going on. I was terrified and transfixed by what was happening. I couldn't believe it. After a few minutes, several other men wearing white lab coats entered the room. They briefly examined El, who was now slumped listlessly in the chair. They mumbled a few words to each other. One of the men waved to the gallery window. A gurney was immediately rolled into the room by two attendants. These men lifted El's limp body onto the gurney, strapped her down across her chest and arms, and rolled it out of the room. I was immediately escorted out of the interview room by the MPs and taken directly to my quarters, where I was locked in my room with the MPs remaining at guard outside the door. 141 After about half an hour there was a knock at the door to my quarters. When I opened it, General Twining entered, together with the machine operator in the white lab coat. The general introduced the man to me as Dr. Wilcox. 241, footnote. He asked me to accompany him and the doctor. We left the room, followed by the MPs. After several twists and turns through the complex, we entered a small room where El had been wheeled on the gurney. The general told me that El and the Domain were considered to be a very great military threat to the United States. El had been immobilized so that she could not depart and return to her base, as she said she would do in the interview. It would be a very grave risk to national security to allow El to report what she observed during her time at the base. So, it had been determined that decisive action was needed to prevent this. The general asked me if I understood why this was necessary. I said that I did, although I most certainly did not agree that it was the least bit necessary, and I certainly did not agree with the surprise attack on El and me in the interview room. However, I said nothing about this to the general because I was very afraid of what might happen to me and El if I protested. Dr. Wilcox asked me to approach the gurney and stand next to El. El lay perfectly still and unmoving on the bed. I could not tell whether she was alive or dead. Several other men in white lab coats, who I assumed were also doctors, stood on the opposite side of the bed. They had connected two pieces of monitoring equipment to El's head, arms and chest. One of these devices I recognized from my training as a surgical nurse as an ache machine 242, footnote, which is used to detect electrical activity in the brain. The other device was a normal hospital room vital signs monitor, which I knew would be useless since El did not have a biological body. Dr. Wilcox explained to me that he had administered a series of mild electroshocks to El in an attempt to subdue her long enough to allow the military authorities time to evaluate the situation and determine what to do with El. He asked me to attempt to communicate with El, telepathically. I tried for several minutes but couldn't sense any communication from El. I couldn't even sense whether El was present in the body any longer. I think you must have killed her, I said to the doctor. Dr. Wilcox told me that they would keep El under observation and that I would be asked to return later to try to establish communication with El again. 142 Chapter 15 My Interrogation, Matilda O'Donnell McElroy Personal Note. The next morning I was escorted from my quarters, under the guard of four MPs, to the interview room. El's overstuffed chair had been removed from the room and replaced by a small desk and several office chairs. I was asked to sit down and wait to be interviewed. After a few minutes, Dr. Wilcox came into the office together with another man wearing a plain business suit. The man introduced himself as John Reed. 243. Footnote, Dr. Wilcox explained to me that Mr. Reed had been flown in from Chicago at the request of my superior officers to conduct a lie detector 244, footnote, test on me. My surprise at this statement was so obvious, that Dr. Wilcox noticed that I was obviously taken aback, and insulted, at the insinuation that I had ever lied about anything. Nonetheless, Mr. Reed began to set up his polygraph device on the desk next to my chair, while Dr. Wilcox continued to explain, in a calm voice, that the test was being administered for my own protection. Since all of the interviews with the alien had been conducted telepathically, and N had declined to read in a test that the typed transcripts were accurate, the truth and accuracy of the statements contained in the transcripts depended entirely on my personal word alone. There was no other reliable way to test the accuracy of the transcripts without submitting me to a battery of tests and psychological examinations to determine, in the opinion of experts, meaning himself, whether the transcripts should be taken seriously, or not. The tone of his voice said very clearly, or dismissed as the delusional ranting of a mere woman. Mr. Reed proceeded to strap a rubber tube around my chest, as well as an ordinary blood pressure cuff around my upper arm. He then placed electrodes on the fingers and surfaces of my hands. He explained that he would be very objective during the interview because he had been thoroughly trained in scientific interrogation. This training was supposed to make his interrogation free from human error. Mr. Reed explained to me that, in response to the questions he and Dr. Wilcox were going to ask me, that actual physiological changes would be transmitted through a small panel unit. The readings would then be tracked on moving graph paper, which he placed beside the machine on the desk. The parallel graphs on the paper would then be correlated and interpreted by Mr. Reed, with the expert assistance of Drive Wilcox, to determine whether or not I was lying. 143 Both Mr. Reed and Dr. Wilcox asked me a series of innocuous questions to begin, which advanced into a more pointed interrogation about my interviews with Al. Here is what I remember about the questions. What is your name?
Matilda O'Donnell, I replied.
What is your date of birth?
June 12, 1924 inches, I said.
What is your age?
23.
Where were you born?
Los Angeles, California, I said.
And so on, and so forth. Are you able to communicate by telepathy?
No.
I have never been able to do this with anyone except Al, I said.
Were any of the statements you made to the stenographer falsified?
No, I answered.
Have you intentionally or unintentionally imagined or fabricated any of the communication you claim to have had with the alien?
No. Of course not, I said.
Are you intentionally attempting to deceive anyone?
No.
Are you attempting to obstruct this test?
No.
What color are your eyes?
144 Blue.
Are you a Catholic?
Yes.
Would you tell the same stories to your parish priest in a Catholic church confessional that you told to the stenographer here at the base?
Yes.
Are you trying to hide anything from us?
No.
Nothing.
Do you believe everything the alien communicated to you?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself to be a gullible person?
No.
The questions continued in this manner for more than an hour. Finally, I was unhooked from the polygraph machine and allowed to return to my quarters, still under guard by the MPs. Later in the afternoon, I returned to the interview room. This time the desk was replaced by a hospital gurney. Dr. Wilcox was accompanied by a staff nurse this time. He asked me to lie down on the gurney. He said that he had been requested to ask me the same series of questions that I answered for the lie detector test. This time, however, I would respond to the questions under the influence of a truth serum, 245, footnote, known as sodium pentothal. As a trained surgical nurse, I was familiar with this barbiturate drug as it was sometimes used as an anesthetic. Dr. Wilcox asked me if I had any objection to submitting to such a test. I told him that I had nothing to hide. I cannot recall anything about this interview. I assumed that when I finished answering the questions, I was escorted back to my room by the MPs, with their assistance this time, as I was too wobbly and woozy from the drug to navigate by myself. However, I had a very peaceful sleep that night. Apparently, neither of these interrogations yielded any suspicious results, as I was not asked any more questions after that. Thankfully, I was left alone during the rest of my time at the base. 145 Chapter 16 Al departs. Matilda O'Donnell McElroy Personal Note: I remained at the base,
mostly confined to Mike Waters, for another 3 weeks after Ale had been incapacitated by Dr. Wilcox. Once a day I was escorted to the room where Ale lay on the bed under continued surveillance by Dr. Wilcox, and others, I assume. Each time I went to the room, I was asked to try to communicate with Ale again. Each time there was no response. This saddened me a great deal. As the days continued, I became increasingly more certain and distressed that Ale was dead, if that is the right word for it. Every day, I reread the transcripts of my interviews with Ale, searching for a clue that might remind me of something or help me in some way to re-establish communication with Ale. I still had the envelope in my possession with copies of the transcripts that Ale was asked to sign. To this day, I don't understand why no one ever asked me to return them. I suppose they forgot about the copy of the transcripts in all the excitement. I did not offer to return them. I kept them concealed under the mattress of my bed all the time I remained at the base, and have kept them with me ever since then. You will be the first person to see these transcripts. Since Ale's body was not biological, the doctors could not detect whether the body was alive or dead unless it moved. Of course, I knew that if Ale was not consciously animating the body as an is be, the body would not move. I explained this to Dr. Wilcox. I explained this to him several times. Each time he just gave me a patronizing sort of smile, patted my arm, and thanked me for trying again. At the end of the third week, I was told by Dr. Wilcox that my services would no longer be needed because it had been decided by the military to move Ale to a larger, more secure military medical facility that was better equipped to deal with the situation. He didn't say anything about where the facility was located. That was the last time I saw Ale's dull body. The following day I received written orders, signed by General Twining. The orders said that I had completed my service to the U.S. military and was officially discharged from further duty, and that I would receive an honorable discharge and a generous military pension. I would also be relocated by the military, and given a new identity with the appropriate documents. 146. Along with the orders, I received a document that I was instructed to read and sign. It was an oath of secrecy. The language of the document was full of legalese, but the point was very clearly made that I was to never, ever discuss anything whatsoever with anyone whatsoever about anything whatsoever that I had seen, heard or experienced during my service in the military, under pain of death, as an act of treason against the United States of America. As it turned out, I was placed into a federal government witness protection program 246, footnote, except that I would be protected from the government by the government. In other words, as long as I stayed quiet, I could stay alive. The following morning I was placed aboard a small military transport plane and flown to a relocation destination. After being shuttled to several locations for short periods, I eventually ended up in Glasgow, Montana, near Fort Peck. The night before I was scheduled to board the transport plane, as I lay in bed contemplating the whole affair and wondering what happened to Ale, and to me, I suddenly heard Ale's voice. I sat bolt upright in my bed and turned on the light on the nightstand. I looked around the room frantically for a few seconds. Then I realized that it was Ale, the ISB. Her body was not in the room with me, of course, and it didn't need to be. She said hello. The tone of her thought was plain and friendly. It was unmistakably Ale. I did not have the least doubt about that. I thought, Ale? Are you still here? She answered that she was here, but not in a body on Earth. She had returned to her post at the domain base when the doctor and MPs attacked us in the interview room. She was pleased to perceive that I was well, and that I was going to be released unharmed. I wondered how she escaped from them. I was worried that they might have injured Ale by the shock machine. Ale said that she was able to leave the body before the shock was administered and avoided the electric current running through the body. She wanted to let me know that she was safe and not to worry about her. I was very relieved, to say the least. I asked Ale if I would ever see her again. Ale reassured me that we are both ISBs. We are not a physical bodies. Now that she had located me in space and time, we would always stay in communication. Elle wished me well and my communication with her ended for the moment. 147 Postscript from Mrs. McElroy. Editor note: the following message was enclosed in a separate envelope marked Read Me Last, together with the original letter. The transcripts and the other notes of explanation I received in the envelope from Mrs. McElroy. This is what the message said: the other documents in this envelope are the end of the story, as far as what happened back in 1947. However, several months after the government got me settled at my final relocation destination, I continued my communication with Elle on a regular basis. It has been almost exactly 40 years since the crash at Roswell. Since then, it has become obvious to me that I have been able to communicate telepathically with Elle for one reason: I'm one of the 3,000 members of the Lost Battalion. At this time, all of the members of the Lost Battalion have been located on Earth as a result of the Domain and Yonaki mission and their use of the Tree of Life detection device. Through my communication with Elle, I have recovered some of my memory of lives I've spent on Earth over the past 8,000 years. Most of these memories are not especially important compared to the long backtrack of events, but it has been a necessary stepping stone to regaining my awareness and ability as an ISB. I can also remember some dim patches of my life in the Domain Expeditionary Force. I was a nurse there too. For the most part, I've been a nurse over and over and over again down through the ages. I stick with being a nurse because it is familiar to me. And I enjoy the work of helping people, as well as members of the race of biological beings in the Domain whose bodies look more like insects than mammals, especially their hands. Even dull bodies need some repair once in a while, too. As I remember more about my past, I realize that the rest of my life is in the future. Eternity is not just in the past. Eternity is in the future. At 1:48, this point I am still not able to fully return to the Domain. I am sentenced to eternal imprisonment, like all other ISBs in a living hell called Earth, until we can disable the old Empire Force screens. Because I won't keep my biological body much longer now, I am intensely aware that very soon I will be recycled through the amnesia process of the old Empire, and stuck back into another baby body to start all over again, without any memory of what went before. As you know, members of the Domain Expeditionary Force have been working to solve this problem for thousands of years. Elle says that even though the Domain has located all of the Lost Battalion officers and crew, the success of freeing them depends on the ISBs who are already on Earth. The Domain Central Command cannot authorize any personnel or resources, at this time, to conduct a rescue mission, as this is not the primary mission of the Domain Expeditionary Force in this galaxy. So, if ISBs on Earth are going to escape from this prison, it will have to be an inside job, so to speak. The inmates will have to figure out how to get themselves out. Various methods of recovering the memory and ability of ISBs have been developed over the past 10,000 years on Earth, but none have proven to be consistently effective so far. Elle mentioned that the most significant breakthrough was made by Gautama Siddhartha about 2,500 years ago. However, the original teachings and techniques taught by the Buddha have been altered or lost over the millennia since then. The practical techniques of his philosophy were perverted into robotic religious rituals by priests as a self-serving instrument of control or slavery. However, another major advance occurred recently. An acquaintance of the commanding officer of the Domain Expeditionary Force Space Station is an ISB who had once been an important engineer and officer in the old Empire Space Fleet. He became an untouchable himself about 10,000 years ago and was sentenced to Earth for leading a mutiny against the oppressive 149 regime of the old Empire. The engineer was trained in advanced scientific improvisation theory thousands of years ago. This man has applied his expertise to helping the Domain solve the apparently unsolvable problem of rescuing the members of the Lost Battalion, as well as the ISBs on Earth. Careful observation and experimental analysis of the mechanics of memory in ISBs by he and his wife, who assisted him, led to the realization that ISBs can recover from amnesia and also regain lost abilities. Together they discovered and developed effective methods that they used to rehabilitate their own memories.